Hello and welcome to Forbidden History Radio, where we explore humanity's hidden history, out-of-place artifacts, lost civilizations, and startling evidence that we could be suppressed.
So yet again, another excellent show. Today we have Robert Ruval coming on to talk about his new book, Black Genesis. Robert Ruval was born in Egypt in 1948. He studied construction engineering in England and subsequently worked in the Middle East and Africa until 1985. In 1994, he published The Orion Mystery, which was a number one bestseller and now translated in more than 25 languages. He also wrote Keeper of Genesis in 1996 with Graham Hancock, which was also a number one bestseller and now in more than 20 languages. He lives in Spain with his wife, Michelle, and I'm just so happy to have him here on the show. Hi, Robert. How are you?
Hi. How are you?
I am wonderful.
Before we start, can I ask you how am I supposed to call you? Dr. Luis, Dr. Rita, or just Rita?
You can call me Rita. You can call me Dr. Rita. Either is fine.
I'll take Rita.
Okay.
Good. Okay, shoot.
Okay. While we were talking about... a little bit before the show, you mentioned that you had some insights about what was going on in Egypt currently, and I would love to hear, you know, there's so much news about it happening recently with, you know, the rioting and the controlling of the internet and et cetera, et cetera. What's going on? I mean, I know it's not our topic, but it sounds like it would be interesting to find out.
Well, as you introduced me, I was born in Egypt. I've actually lived in Egypt until 1967. I was 19 when I left Egypt. And I've been back many, many times. Very recently, I spent 3 years in Cairo, from 2005 to 2008. So I'm very into Egypt, apart from my work, as you must be aware. What's happened in Egypt, basically, in very simple terms, is a revolution. The regime, the old regime, has been toppled. It collapsed on the 11th of February. And they are, since then, in a moment of flux, really. I mean, it's very, very confusing. Like all revolutions, really. I mean, I've personally studied the French Revolution and the American War of Independence. On a book I did with Graham Hancock in 2006, which, by the way, is coming out in a different format in August. It's called The Master Game. It will be out in New York with a New York publisher around August time. But anyway, the point is that what's very exciting is that not only it's a revolution in the making. It's like taking a time machine and going back to France in 1789. And I mean, today we've had it on television. I don't know if you were watching all this in February, but I mean, we had a sort of 24-hour cameras literally showing us this event. But it's a very unusual revolution. It's one of the rare revolutions in history that was almost bloodless. And I'm very proud of this, because I never thought that such a revolution would happen, let alone in the reasonably orderly manner it did. Although 850 people died, considering there is 90 million people in Egypt, and considering the kind of regime they were toppling, one of the most dictatorial and oppressive regimes in the Middle East, it went down quite well. However, since then, there is a lot of confusion, and... we're not quite sure how this is going to play out on the long run. We'll find out very soon, soon enough in October when they have elections. But so many new political parties have emerged, some of them in total opposition to others. There is the, of course, the worrying one is the Muslim Brotherhood, which was illegal in Egypt until the revolution. Now it's become an official party, and although they have, I know this is a big worrying thing for the United States. The last thing we want is Egypt turning into an Islamic Republic. But there's a lot of weird conclusions and talks going on. I'm putting my bets that, and hopefully I hope I'm right, that we're going to have a very secular government with an Islamic background. I mean, I was very encouraged by the position that the Grand Mullah of Al-Azhar. The Grand Mullah of Al-Azhar is the equivalent of the Pope. Are you still there, Rita?
I am. I'm just listening.
You got to interrupt me because I'm a bit. First of all, I don't stop unless you interrupt me, and secondly, sometimes I keep on talking and we're off the air. So anyway, to cut this matter short, the Grand Mullah of Al-Azhar University, which is really the spokesman for the Islamic world, has reconfirmed that what everybody wants is a secular government, with, of course, an understanding that Egypt is and has always been, or at least since the 7th century, an Islamic country. That's fine. If it takes that kind of position, it would be like Turkey. We will have a secular government in an Islamic country. It's a bit like a secular government in the United States being a Christian or recognized as a Christian country. So I'm hoping for that, and I have a feeling that that's what most Egyptians want. But,
great.
You know, so that's the situation. I was there recently, by the way, and I was very, very pleased with at least the psychological effect the revolution has had. I think it's very hard for those who haven't been under an oppressed regime to understand this, but Egyptians have lived under an oppressive regime for the last 5,000 years, and especially in the last 60 years under the military junta. So it's wonderful to see people being able to talk, to express their views without being afraid. It's really a very refreshing thing. So at least from that point of view, there's been a big change.
One of the things that I am hoping would come out of this, although now I'm a little bit concerned again, was that when the revolution happened, Zahi Hawass was taken out of his position of power of the antiquities, and I thought, well, maybe some of the alternative history or evidence that has come out that has looked at the history of Egypt would become recognized by scholars. But then he was put back in place, and so I'm not quite sure how that's going to play out. But do you have any thoughts as far as information, historical information, that I would think that you think is being suppressed, I think is being suppressed in Egypt, if that will start to come out as being real, as opposed to, you know, they had a show here where Zahi called people like yourself, pyramidiots, which I thought was really pretty insulting.
well, we're kind of getting used to Zahi. it is a strange story, I have to say. I mean, I've been following this Zahi conundrum over the last 20 years. I'm a bit puzzled, really, at the events that have happened over the last 5-6 months. But before I say anything, I am actually commissioned now to write a book with an Egyptian author, Ahmed Osman. Ahmed Osman lives in London. He used to be a journalist in Egypt. He's now in his early 70s and has written many books on the theories that equate biblical characters to historical characters in Egypt. He's the one who started the suggesting that Moses might have been Achelat and so forth. But he's also written many books on Islam, on contemporary Islam, and he's very up to date in the political scene. He has a column in several newspapers. Anyway, I'm writing a book with him on this particular matter, on the whole history of the antiquities department, starting with the coming of Napoleon in 1789, 1798 in Egypt, and all the way to the revolution and the events that have happened over the last 5 months. It is a very strange story, and hasn't been told properly. The antiquities in Egypt have been in the hands of a very confusing background. For a long time, they were open for anybody to help themselves. Since the 1950s, although under Egyptian authority, and Zahi is the last in line of these directors. He's now a minister because they've made it into a ministry. The rule of Zahi Hawass has been a rather strange one, I must say. And I've met him many, many times. And I must say that I'm not clear at all as why this man is still there. He is greatly disliked, both in Egypt and around the world, really. I mean, he's kind of shot himself in the foot with this program. I don't know if you've seen it, called Chasing Mummies.
That's where he called the people the Pyramidiots. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's called, well, he seems to have got upset with everybody on this program. But he is a rather strange man, and he has a very peculiar view about himself. He's very, very, to put it in mild terms, he's very authoritative. It's gone beyond the point of comprehension. I mean, he won't allow different opinions. He runs his department with screams and shouts and bullying. And it's rather very odd to see. But this is neither here nor there. What is really the point is that the events over the last 4 or 5 months have been rather weird, because he was very much part of the old regime. He was extremely close to the Mubarak family, particularly Suzanne Mubarak, the wife of the ousted president. This was extremely well known in Egypt. Indeed, on two occasions, Mubarak has created a special post for Zahi Hawass in order to stay in power. Everybody was a bit surprised in 2009, I think, if I'm not mistaken, when Zahi had reached the age of retirement. In Egypt, officials have to retire at the age of 63, but not ministers. In order for him to stay, President Mubarak created a new post as Vice Minister of Culture, as well as Under Secretary of State for Antiquities. So that made it possible for Zahi to stay on. Clearly, a very supportive and special relationship was between Zahi and President Mubarak. And then again, during the heat of the revolution, when President Mubarak reshuffled the cabinet before he finally stepped down, he created the post of Minister of Antiquities. This did not exist before. There was a Secretary General, and Zahi was Secretary General of the Supreme Council of Antiquities. This was converted into a ministry, and Zahi was made minister. When President Mubarak was ousted on the 11th of February, Zahi, realizing that this was the end of the Mubarak regime, rather than wait to be asked to leave, resigned. He offered his resignation. And there was a big confusion whether his resignation was valid. We all thought that was it, that's the end. But then strange things happened with the new provisional government, which is headed by Issam Sharaf. What happened is that Issam Sharaf, first of all, declared that he was going to separate again the Ministry of Culture with the new Ministry of Antiquities. The way it was before was that the Ministry of Culture headed the Supreme Council of Antiquities. In other words, that antiquities were under the Ministry of Culture. and that's how it has always been. Now, it had been changed by President Mubarak, and his son Sharaf said, no, okay, we're going to change it and separate them and bring this so-called new Ministry of Antiquities back into the Ministry of Culture. And then it was announced that there was a new Ministry of Culture, and then it was announced that a professor of Cairo University was going to head the antiquities. This was official. This was in the newspaper. And suddenly we were all taken by surprise by the announcement that Zahi Hawass was reinstalled. What happened is not clear. I'm puzzled because, first of all, this was an extremely bad sign for the revolution to have an old regime cabinet minister reinstalled. Apparently the excuse was that there was nobody else to take over the antiquities, which is a bit absurd, really. I mean, there are a lot of good people who can run this department, and in fact better than Zahi. And since then, Zahi has been accused of all sorts of things. I mean, he was in fact sentenced to 1 year in jail.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you follow this.
I heard about that one.
So I thought, well, I mean, how can it be that not only here we have a minister of the old regime being reinstalled, and then he's sentenced to 1 year hard labor in jail, actually sentenced, the criminal court has sentenced him, and then he's still there. There has been all sorts of accusation in public about corruption, about trafficking of antiquities. But the man is, I mean, they begin to call him Mr. Teflon. I mean, he's, nothing sticks. So that tells me something that is a bit worrying, that there is something behind this, and I can't fathom it. And it seems to stem from a rather unusual support coming from the United States. There is a very keen support for him coming from rather high quarters, particularly in the big media, to have him there. But that's it. Beyond that, I really don't know what's keeping that man there. As for the alternatives, getting permission, I'm not quite sure what's going to happen. He has been rather difficult, to say the least, in allowing people to research there. He has, not just the alternatives, he has been very aggressive towards other fellow Egyptologists, should they step on his turf. He has caused a lot of problems to Joanne Fletcher, the British Egyptologist, when she announced the discovery of Nefertiti's mummy. He just went bananas. You've seen him on Tracing Mummies. I mean, he is a very, very megalomaniac sort of person. I mean,
he's the pharaoh.
Well, you know, pharaohs have gone
in his own mind.
Well, it's puzzling because you know, I know other ministers in Egypt, and they're very, very, very sophisticated people. They're very civilized. They're very normal. His behavior is rather strange. He justifies it as being passion. You know, he says this is a demonstration of his passion. But certainly in Chasing Mummies, it went beyond a passionate person. I mean, he really lost it once or twice, even with the TV producers. I mean, it was rather embarrassing to see. But, you know, I have this feeling, and I may be wrong, but I think his days are numbered. I think he's just hanging on at the moment. There was a lot of opposition against him a couple of weeks ago during one of those Tahrir gatherings. Many people of his department have expressed strongly their views in demonstrations to have him out. There's a bafflement among many people in Egypt as to how come he's still there. You know, and we'll see. He's on tour, by the way, in the States, I think, at the moment, promoting tourism. He's been giving. Hello, you still there, Rita?
I'm still here.
Oh, okay.
This is just really interesting. He's one of my favorite topics of Egyptology to talk about because I just feel like with him holding that party line, you know, the pyramids were made 3500 BC, and this is how it happened. And if you have a viewpoint that's different than that, I don't want to talk to you, and I don't want to hear it, and that's not how it is. And I was like, maybe if he's gone, somebody else can have an opinion.
Well, I mean, we have our opinions, whether he likes it or not. I mean, his only way to stop this is to prevent people getting permits to do research in Egypt. But I've been expressing my opinions quite openly over the last 20 years. But what is peculiar about all this is that, considering his situation, considering the events of the revolution, considering the kind of person he is, it's very puzzling that he's still there. I mean, I call him the George Bush of Egyptology. I mean, it's a bit like George Bush. I mean, it was very strange to see a man who shouldn't be there. You know, he just didn't fit the role. It just was bizarre. And so I think he's going to end up like George Bush. I think his people have seen through the person. Chasing Bami was not a good idea. And I don't think he has that kind of aura anymore in America, so I'm told. You know, they've created, Zahi Hawass is a created person. Mm-hmm. He is not what people think he is when they used to see him on television. Big media has given the image of an Indiana Jones, you know, a very passionate and, you know, a colorful sort of character. Chasing Bami showed him in a very different light, in the real light that he is. A rather confused man who does not want to talk to anybody, has very, very, very old-fashioned ideas about how to manage people, very rough in his approach, and totally blocked in opening up the subject. I mean, there is a lot of research. I mean, recently, for example, what's her name? Sarah Kaczek, I always forget her name, who did the infrared research. You've heard about this?
No, I haven't.
It was a big deal a couple of weeks ago. She's a professor of Egyptology in Alabama, University of Alabama, and they've developed a technique using satellite infrared imagery. And she's detected a lot of with infrared photography. She's been able to pinpoint what may be ruins. One of the big deals was that she thought she had found some pyramids in the Abu Sir area. They did a documentary. The BBC did a documentary. It was shown a month ago, and he was in it. And yet he went bananas afterwards and said that he's very angry when people do not ask his permission, even when it comes to doing documentaries. And I think it's absurd. I mean, I don't need Zahi Hawass's permission to do a documentary or publish a book. He wants to control Egyptian antiquities to the point of the ridiculous. And I mean, there was a time, believe it or not, he actually wanted to copyright the pyramid. He wanted to forbid people taking photographs or writing about the pyramids. It's true. He actually declared that he had asked the copyright department to look into this. I mean, it's bizarre. Anyway, let's change the subject.
That's pretty funny. Yeah. You know, there are in Egypt a multitude of exceptional sites. But what you really rarely hear about, and probably is the oldest, or that you've talked about, is the Nabta Playa. What is or where is Nabta Playa?
Uh-huh. Yes, this is very much one of the main topics of this book that I have just published with Thomas Brophy. Just a little introduction. Thomas Brophy is a physicist who lives in San Diego. I've known Thomas for quite a few years. And he had written a book called The Origin Map, which was about Nabta Playa. At the time when he published this book, he talks a lot about me in this book. And we got in touch, and eventually we decided to write a book about the origins of the ancient Egyptians, because Nafta Playa is a key site that that allows us to come to a lot of conclusions. It's okay, geographically, Nafta Playa is in about 100 kilometers due west of Abu Simbel. Abu Simbel is the furthest town south in Egypt. Beyond that is the Sudanese country. So if you're at Abu Simbel and you head 100 kilometers due west, that means into the western desert, you reach Nafta Playa. Nafta Playa is a prehistoric site. It long predates the pharaonic era. It has a very strange history in terms of its discovery. It was discovered in 1974 by an American team led by Fred Wendorf, the anthropologist, the Southern Methodist University of Texas. He was at the time doing a lot of research in the Egyptian Western Desert on prehistoric sites, particularly because there still is a project to flood the area from the Lake Nasser. The Egyptian government has contracted the building of a huge canal, a sort of second Nile, that will feed the Western Desert, and a lot of these prehistoric sites, unfortunately, will be flooded, a bit like what happened in 65 with Lake Nasser, when there was a threat of losing Abu Simbel and the temple of Phila and so forth. So he put together, Fred Wendorf put together a team to record all these sites before they got flooded. Fortunately, so far the project has been halted, so I hope that this will not happen. In any case, in 1974, Fred Wendorf and his team were driving back to Abu Simbel from deep into the desert and stopped at this spot, which eventually was called Nafta Playa, to have what they called a comfort break. They were going to have a pee. And they very quickly realized that all around them were these strange, a lot of potsherds, a lot of tools, stone tools lying about, and particularly strange stones that seemed to be put in conglomeration. They very quickly realized that this was a prehistoric site, and got permission to do research there, and they set up a team called the Combined Prehistoric Expedition. They joined forces with the Polish Academy of Science, led by a fellow called Romuald Schild. And there they were, studying this site. It took them a while, strangely enough, one of the things they realized very quickly was that it wasn't a settlement. It wasn't a place where people lived. It was what they eventually called a ceremonial site. It was a place where people gathered to perform rituals, a bit like Stonehenge in England. In fact, one of the artifacts at Nafta Playa is a rather intriguing stone circle, which has been dubbed the mini Stonehenge of the desert. It's not as nowhere near as large as Stonehenge, but it has the same characteristics. It's a circle having astronomical alignments. It took a long time for them to realize that this site was not just a ceremonial site, but it was more specifically a ceremonial site with a strong astronomical input. This they realized in 1996 or 97 when they invited an astronomer from Boulder, Colorado, Professor Kim Malville, who very quickly realized that what he was looking at was alignments towards the various stations of the sun, and later discovered that there was a lot of stellar alignments. To cut a long story short, they eventually published very conservatively a letter in the science journal Nature, which caused a sensation because they declared that they had found the oldest astronomical calendar in the world, predating Stonehenge by several thousand years. That is the importance of Nabta Playa, not just its antiquity, but because it is the oldest site that we know in the world where ancient people perform astronomical observations. What was even more intriguing about Nabta Playa was that there were stellar alignments. There were long lines of stones heading towards the eastern horizon and the northern horizon. And the surprise came when Kim Melville worked out that these alignments were aiming at the very constellations that the pyramid builders many thousand years later used, particularly Orion's Belt, particularly the star Sirius, and in the north, particularly the Big Dipper.
All right, Robert, let's come back to that topic, because I have some questions about that whole astronomical alignment part. But let's go back to the site itself. When you said it's a mini Stonehenge, is this place made up of giant, you know, standing stones like we see in Stonehenge, or is it something different?
Okay, I think there's a bit of a confusion, which is well explained in our book, but for the sake of your listeners, it is nowhere near the size of Stonehenge. The stones are much smaller. The largest are about, I would say, half a ton, maybe a ton. So the idea that it resembles anything like Stonehenge is not true. But, you know, it doesn't have to be big to be important. What's massively important about Nabta Playa is that not only astronomy was done there thousands of years before Stonehenge, but the kind of astronomy that we've detected there is amazing. It's almost certain that what they were doing were they were also observing the displacement of the stars over the epochs caused by the precessional effect. Precession is a wobble of the Earth that takes 26,000 years, and it gives the impression that the stars are displacing themselves at their point of rising and their point of setting. And these people seem to have been observing this, because that's what Kim Melville discovered, is that the lines that pointed towards the rising of this specific constellation, like Orion's Belt and Sirius and the Big Dipper, were changing over the epochs. Now this is stunning, because even today, astronomers do not think that precession was known until the time of the Greeks. Although in my opinion, there is no doubt in my mind that the pharaohs of the pyramid age were aware of precession. But to have a primitive prehistoric culture doing this thousands of years before completely changed the picture. And not only that, but they were doing it with the very stars that we thought were used only by the pharaohs of the pyramid age. So here we had a people hardly 100 kilometers from the Nile, there for thousands of years before the pharaonic civilization emerged, doing precisely the kind of astronomy that the pyramid builders did thousands of years later. So that was the big, big surprise, is that it looked like the kind of science that we had attributed to the pyramid builders was in fact not original to them, but had been developed by these prehistoric people who were in the Sahara thousands of years before. So that is the importance of Nabta Playa. Now, there is
how far back are we talking here? I mean, you're saying a few thousand years, so 5,000, 7,000?
Well, Nabta Playa gives us a variety of dates. We have been able to detect that people came to Nabta Playa about 9,000 to 10,000 years ago. Now, that puts the presence of these people in that area at least 6,000 to 7,000 years before the pyramid builders. That's the kind of difference we're talking about, the time scale. We know that not only they settled in Nabta Playa perhaps around the 6th or 7th millennium BC, but that they stay there for several thousand years. They suddenly disappear around 3500 BC. And here is the interesting part, is that when they disappear, the pharaonic civilization emerges. And, you know, it doesn't take a rocket engineer to realize that these people must have gone. The reason they disappeared is that the area became impossible to sustain life. The desert became super arid. There was no more rainfalls. There were, the wells had dried up. And they were literally forced to move. And the logical place for them to go was towards the Nile. And it, therefore, it doesn't come as a surprise at all that the pharaonic civilization begins in the distant south, adjacent to Nafta Playa. We're not the only people saying this, by the way. I mean, most anthropologists today are of this conclusion. And Egyptologists are slowly coming around now to the very strong possibility that the pharaonic civilization owes its origins to this black African people that lived in the Sahara for thousands of years. And there is no doubt at all that they themselves, these prehistoric people, had come from Central Africa. So it's a huge, huge change in perception. There was a lot of belief. There's still a lot of resistance in Egyptology. I mean, that the Egyptian pharaonic civilization is a homegrown civilization, that it simply spurted out along the Nile Valley. Well, that's not the case. The truth is coming out very strongly now. I mean, the evidence is overwhelming, and every day there is more and more evidence that a prehistoric black African people. Let me give you a time scale, because I think this is very important. We now know, and I say when we, I'm talking about anthropologists, paleoanthropologists, and everybody involved in the study of human history, that the origins of modern man is in Central Africa, probably Central East Africa, sometime around 200,000 years ago. We know this because genetic studies that have been done over the last 20 years have confirmed this without any doubt. It's called mtDNA, the tracing of the female gene back. And we know that there's a point in time, sometime around 200,000 years ago, when primitive man, Homo erectus, a woman, we call her now the African Eve, gave birth to the first modern human. This is a fact now. How and why it happened, we don't know, but this happened. And whether it was a man or a woman, we don't know. But the first modern human was born in Central Africa 200,000 years ago. And what happened since was that around 60,000 years ago, a group of these modern humans left and started moving around. Many of them stayed in Africa, of course, and this is the African population we have today. But a group started migrating towards the Nile, across the Levant, into Europe, and eventually populated the world. Every single human being that is alive today on every continent comes from this source. To put it in a very simple terms, and it may come as a kind of perhaps a strange terminology, but you know, we are all black Africans turned white. You know, that's the truth. Anyway, the point is that it seems that one group, and this is the group we're interested in, rather than move northwards into the Levant, moved southwest and settled in what today we know as the Chad Inesti region. It's a mountainous region. We know that because there's a lot of prehistoric evidence there. And it seems that it is these people who eventually came down into the Sub-Sahara, stayed in the Sub-Sahara for a long time. Now what is interesting, what happened there was that the climate changed. The Sahara was very fertile in prehistoric times. There was the monsoons that still occur in Central Africa. It used to reach that part of the what is now the dry Sahara, and would cause the creation of temporary lakes. There was beautiful pastoral fields, very fertile, and these people lived in a very very habitable condition. But the weather changed, the climatic conditions changed, and there was a rather abrupt change around 10,000 years ago, 12,000 years ago perhaps. And the Sahara became drier and drier. Now, what the effect it had on the people that lived for so many years in very, very wonderful conditions, with fauna all around them, with lakes, began to be more difficult. And they were forced to move long distances to find water. And this is very interesting because it forced them to learn how to navigate in these vast open regions of the desert. And that's where the stars, or rather the astronomy, comes into play. They began to realize that they could use the sky as a guidance, as navigators. They became desert navigators. They still do this, by the way. There are still tribes in the Sahara that still navigate with the stars. The other thing that occurred was that rather than being hunters, where they had fauna all around them, they were obliged to take along their food, and it forced them to domesticate cattle. We now know that the people who eventually became the people of Nabta Playa had domesticated cattle at least 500, perhaps even 1,000 years before the domestication of cattle Hello?
I'm still here. I'm just listening.
Somebody else is trying to butt in. And they had domesticated cattle. They probably were the very first. All this is caused by the pressure on them caused by the climate. And not only they had to navigate long distances, but they had to time their navigation. They had to make sure that when they reached the point of destination, the lakes that they were trying to find, that the rains had occurred. It was very, very dangerous. Literally, their lives depended on this. If they were to arrive too early, the water wouldn't be there. And if they arrived too late, the water would have gone. These were temporary lakes that were fed by the monsoons in the summer months, and they lasted for 4 or 5 months. And this forced them to learn about timekeeping, literally creating calendars. And we have found many of these calendars all over the desert. Nabta Playa is the most sophisticated one, but we found these kind of stone circle calendars deep into the Sahara. I've made an expedition in 2008, and there is more and more of these emerging now because of this satellite imagery that I was telling you about. We begin to realize that there was a vast population roaming the Sahara, a very sophisticated population that were moving around with their cattle, were able to navigate, and what Nabta Playa shows us, they were beginning to develop very sophisticated ideas, religious ideas, because what we find in Nabta Playa is all these ceremonial alignments, rituals, strange burials of cattle. Nabta Playa is full of these very obviously ritualistic primitive constructions. So here is the hub, the beginning of what eventually became the pharaonic civilization, because we have all the ingredients: the domestication of cattle, the knowledge of astronomy, which leads to mathematics, and the moving of large stones. So with this cargo of knowledge, when these people were forced to depart from the desert, they brought all this knowledge with them, and not surprisingly, very quickly the pharaonic civilization emerged along the Nile Valley. So in other words, the pyramids are a product of these people, indirectly. And this is a very, very new way of looking at ancient Egypt. And that's what Black Genesis does. We've tried to put all this into a book. The book is presenting all the studies that have been done, plus a lot of very exciting discoveries that were done in recent years. There's a couple of chapters that focuses on the actual discoveries and the discoverers. Very romantic people, by the way.
One of the things that always amazes me, whether it be the Egyptian culture or the Maya, that they actually had a knowledge and understanding of the precession of the equinox when it's only shifting 1 degree every 72 years, and it just blows my mind how, you know, if a lifetime was 35 to 50 years, how that information could be transmitted down so that somebody would recognize over time that there was actually movement happening. It would be so subtle, even in a few hundred years, the movement of the stars, because it would only be by 2 or 3 degrees.
Well, look, you're right in raising this question, but it's always asked, you know, how did they notice? And, you know, it's very, very simple, really. If you were to align a stones, put them in a row, if you like, towards the rising of a specific star, take Sirius, for example, the star Sirius, all you need to put is 2 or 3 stones in alignment and aim at the sun. In fact, I did this yesterday, by the way, at Friend's place, because it was a summer solstice. And I was at this friend's balcony, and I said, okay, I'm going to mark you the position of sunset. And we literally drew a line on the floor, pointing towards the sunset. So once you've done that, you've marked the position. Now, in the case of a star, you've marked its rising or setting position, all right?
Mm-hmm.
That's it. It's marked. However, after 50 or 60 years, you'd come and watch the rising of this star, and you'd notice that the star was no more in alignment with the stones that you've put. That's it. You've discovered precession. It's as simple as that. And what we have at Napta Playa is that we have, from the same kickoff point, rows of stones that clearly are changing in alignment to follow the position of the star. A bit like the spokes of a bicycle wheel. If you can imagine a central point and then various lines shooting off from the same point but changing slightly. And when we did the calculations, it's very obvious that they were tracking those stars. So that's how they were aware of precession. Now, whether they understood what it was is another matter. It really does not matter whether they understood what it was. They observed it. And, you know, it's a very strange thing. Observation is one of the most important capacities we have as human beings. And not just observing with our eyes. You know, we're equipped with senses. The eyesight is just one of these senses. To observe the world that we're in. And that's how we understand our world. And they did. You know, they were there in the desert trying to figure out what's this world around them. You know, why are they here? You know, why are they those objects in the sky moving? Why is there night and day? Why is there changing climate? Why is there rain? You know, these fundamental questions were there all the time. You know, let me say this because, you know, when I use the word prehistoric, people imagine, you know, people, you know, completely dumb and stupid. It's not true. They had the same brain capacity as us. There must have been Newtons and Einsteins among them. The only difference is that they did not have the science and technology that we have today. But they were very bright people, and they were trying to understand the world with the possibilities they had, and they observed. You know, we may understand the world through studying books and reading, but we stopped observing, and this is not good. You know, I'm always very amazed when people say, well, you know, how could they observe the stars of Orion's belt and put the pyramids in the same pattern? Well, it's very easy. You just have to look at them and draw them. You know, but people, you know, they didn't have telescopes. For example, Egyptologists tell you, oh, they didn't have telescopes. How could they be so precise? You'd be amazed how precise you can be without telescopes. You know, if you observe and all you have to do is point a stick and you've got the rising point of a star. So, you know, this is what was there. And more so, we had people who lived in those conditions, in open desert conditions, every day, every night. They were acutely aware of what was happening in the sky, you know, for all throughout their lives, throughout the centuries. for thousands of years, which is something we don't do. And therefore, we are puzzled. You know, Egyptologists are puzzled when you speak to them in those terms. But when you go out into the desert and you spend a few nights in the open, you realize very quickly why these people were developing all these things and why it's not such a mystery. The mystery is more that the Egyptologists are incapable of digesting this. Now, they have a problem because it's no more theories. There is very hard evidence that ancient people not only practiced these kind of observation, very sophisticated astronomy, but they are at the root of a very sophisticated civilization. This is becoming strong evidence-driven, and Black Genesis is the first book of its kind, for the general public at least, that presents this. We're very, very proud of this book because it's not theoretical. I mean, sure, we discuss many, we have many views and many opinions, but the evidence is hard evidence. You know, there are stones there. There are. We actually can see those people. They've left us drawings of themselves in the region of Gilskibir in the distant southwest. There are caves full of rock art that show us those people in very sophisticated conditions. They have huts. They have houses. They clearly have domesticated cattle. The cattle are in paddocks. They seem to have very sophisticated rituals. You know, it's there. So no more arguments, really. And I was very, very pleased to hear one of the very senior Egyptologists, Salima Ikram. She is, in fact, a Pakistani Egyptologist who has been teaching at Cairo at Cairo for many, many years. She's a very good friend of Zahi Hawass, by the way. Salima Ikram appeared in a documentary which was shown on BBC a couple of weeks ago to do with this infrared imagery that I was describing earlier from excuse me, from the University of Alabama. And the part of the research was done in the Western Desert, where they detected many of these settlements and stone circles. And she, in no uncertain terms, states that the evidence now is such that the pharaonic civilization owes its origins to these prehistoric people from the Egyptian Sahara. Point blank, that's it. You know, the Egyptologists are coming around to this very, very strongly. And to me, it not only opens a window to where the origins were, but it clears the air to a rather more sensitive discussion, is that the origins of pharaonic civilization, and certainly of humankind, is a black African origin. And to me, this is very important, because we're settling a matter here that has been in dispute for a very, very long time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I'm very, very pleased with this book, because we've done a very good job. I mean, I'm blowing my trumpet, of course, but but Black Genesis is a well done book. I'm extremely proud of it. So there you are. That's the story.
Okay. Well, let me just give you a heads up. We are going to go to commercial break in about 4 minutes. Let me ask you, hopefully, a fairly easy question here. Mm-hmm. It just seems to me that interest in the Western Desert has just begun, you know, interest in exploring it has just begun in the last 10 years. And I would think that there's a lot more out there to be discovered.
Absolutely. But when we return, I'll give you an overview about the recent explorations, and it's a very exciting story, so I'll tell you all about it.
Well, then you know what? I'm just going to hit the little music button, and we're going to go to a commercial break. So we're continuing our interview with Robert Bouval about his book, Black Genesis. His webpage, by the way, is robertbouval.co.uk. That's .co.uk. Robert, are you there?
Yep.
Woohoo! I have like a little technology angel on my shoulder today. I'm happy girl.
Good.
Before we went to the break, I was asking you about other sites that might be in that Western Desert, and you said that you had some information about some new stuff that's been found or discovered. Or
yes, I think what you were also asking about the discovery, the exploration of this desert. Let me give you an overall view, because it's a rather exciting story. And I've been part of it. So let me just place your listeners into the context of this Western Desert, which, by the way, I'd rather call the Egyptian Sahara. Egypt, the geography of Egypt, is basically a huge desert divided into two parts by the Nile. There is the River Nile that runs from the distant south all the way to the Mediterranean, and cuts this desert into two parts, the Eastern Desert and the Western Desert. Now, the Western Desert is, in fact, part of the Greater Sahara. So, in many ways, it's better to call it the Egyptian Sahara. People get confused, Eastern Desert, Western Desert. So, this Egyptian Sahara, if you can visualize a huge rectangle that in the north is the Mediterranean, in the distant south, on the other side, is Sudan. On the east is the River Nile. And on the west is Libya. So basically it's a huge rectangle contained by these borders. It's the size, roughly, of France. I mean, it's a massive area. And basically it's just dry desert with... It's wonderful, but it's just dry with dunes and rocks and valleys and canyons and so forth.
Robert, can I ask a really kind of stupid question right now?
Yes.
Being an American, I think most people or a lot of people have this impression that the desert is just one giant sand dune with no beach. Is that a true statement, or is there more terrain than just sand out there?
Oh, no. I mean, the Western Desert is just, it is wonderful. Anyway, let me carry on, because that's going to answer your question. In this vast desert is a string of oases running roughly north to south. There are five major oases. The most northerly one and the biggest is the oasis of Siwa. The oasis of Siwa is an amazing place. I mean, for those who have visited Egypt and are looking for something else, I fully recommend the trip to Siwa. It's a magical place. It's the famous place where Alexander the Great did his pilgrimage, where he believed that he was the son of the god of Siwa, the god Zeus Amon. It's got this wonderful aura about it. The oasis of Siwa, like all oases, is a giant, well, a mini world, really, made of palm groves. It is flanked by, in the south, by dunes, amazing sand dunes that, by the way, begin at Siwa and go further south for about 600 kilometers. It's the largest sand sea in the world. It's incredible. I mean, it's like being in a frozen storm, you know, with these dunes going up to 40, 50 meters in height, and it's really wonderful. On the flanks of the oasis, east and west, are lakes. So you know, it's really very, very magical and beautiful place. The most of the oases are roughly that way. They contain lakes and they have dunes and so forth. But what we call the deep desert, starts from the very last oasis, which is the oasis of Dakhla. People can look it up on the map later on. I have maps in the books, of course. And from Dakhla, from this oasis, which is almost bang in the middle of this vast Egyptian Sahara, when you leave Dakhla and go south or west, you are in what we call the open desert. It's like being in the open sea. That's it. No roads, no nothing. You're just traveling in wilderness. And this is very arid, but very fascinating. And particularly fascinating because we now know it was populated by these prehistoric people. There is prehistoric sites all over the place. But let me say this. There is an area in the distant southwest of Egypt. In other words, at the very far corner of this Egyptian Sahara that forms, that buttresses into Sudan and Libya, the extreme southwest. There is a huge, in fact, two very large mountainous regions. One of them is called Gilf Kibir. It's roughly the size of Switzerland. If you can imagine, that's the way I always describe it. If you can imagine Switzerland without trees, it's a very mysterious region. I'll describe it in a minute. And then there is another one, a bit further south, called Jebel Uwainat. And Jebel Uwainat is one of the most mysterious places in the world. Now, what's amazing is that these areas were not discovered until the 1920s. Nobody knew they were there. The reason nobody knew they were there is that they're so remote that not even the Bedouins went there. And the first person to actually make it there is an Egyptian explorer in 1923. An amazing character. I really have to tell the story. I've almost devoted a chapter to this person in Black Genesis. His name was Ahmed Hassanin. Or rather known as Hassanin Bey. Bey is a title, like Lord. He was rather an extraordinary, a romantic person. He was educated at Oxford, at Balliol College. Among other things, he was head of the Olympic team of fencing. He has an extraordinary story, because he became tutor to the last king of Egypt, King Farouk. And of all things, he became the lover of his mother, Queen Nazli. So you're dealing with a very sort of Omar Sharif type of character there, who, apart from all these passions he had, his greatest passion was to explore the desert. There are pictures of Ahmed Hassanein in Black Genesis. He really looks fantastic. You know, he looks like a sort of Arab Lawrence of Arabia with his veil. Anyway, he organized the first deep desert expedition, starting from the Mediterranean, in the town of Sulum. Now, yes, Hassanein Bey started his expedition in a town called Sulum. You may not know, remember the name, but Sulum has become very, very famous because it is the border town between Libya and Egypt. That's where all the refugees from Libya started coming a couple of months ago. In those days, it was just a very small town. And he started his expedition from there by camel. He took a guide with him, and he entered the desert along the Libyan border. I'm saying this because you'll see that although he discovered Jebel Uwainat, he actually named it Jebel Uwainat. It means little eyes. In Arabic, eyes are synonymous to palms. He found ponds of water. It's the only place where there is water in this desert, by the way. It's the only place. Anyway, he traveled almost 2,000 kilometers, an extraordinary feat in those days, even today. I mean, I can tell you, I went to Jebel Uwainat in 2008 with four-wheel drives, and even with four-wheel drives, it's one hell of a trip. So you can imagine by camel. He reached this place, which was rumored to exist, a sort of Shangri-La that people talked about but had never seen, and he discovered this mountain region, which he named Jebel Uwainat. Very, very mysterious place, I can tell you. However, it was thought to be totally uninhabited. He was extremely surprised to be woken up one morning when he was camping in that region by a young black African girl who offered him a bowl of milk. She did not speak Arabic. She spoke a dialect of what is known as Tebu, which is the language, an ancient language of the Bedouins. Luckily, he had a taboo guide with him, and she surprised Hassan and Bey by telling him, I belong to a tribe of people who live here, and we have a king. Would you like to meet my king? There he goes, and he actually met the king, who was called Harry. There are pictures of King Harry in my book, Black Justice, because Hassan and Bey had a camera with him. And apart from being amazed to find these people there, King Harry informed him that they had been there for as long as they could remember, and that their ancestors had left their drawings. So Hassan said, where? And they took him to see what we know now to be prehistoric rock art. And he was astounded because this rock art had drawings of animals that were not supposed to be there. You know, there was giraffes and hippopotamus and lions and ostriches, all these animals that today you can only find them in Central Africa. And he concluded correctly that there must have been a different climate and that these animals were able to live in these areas. When he returned and announced this discovery, the National Geographic, the Royal National Geographic Society of London, got very, very keen on this. He was also educated at Oxford, as I said earlier, and they invited him to give a talk to describe his expedition. I've put a lot in the book. There is a lot of excerpts from this talk. I managed to find it. It was published in the National Geographic Journal. To me, it's an extraordinary situation. But what Hassan N. Bey did not realize is that on his way to Jebel Weynat, he had bypassed a much larger unknown mountain region, which he couldn't see because it was 100 kilometers away from it. When he returned to Cairo, his trip inspired, of all people, one of the princes, Prince Kamal ed-Din, who was in line for the throne. It shows you how the desert affects people, because Prince Kamal ed-Din rejected the throne of Egypt and decided and declared himself a desert explorer. Of course, he was rather wealthy, and he's the first man, as far as I know, to have designed for him by the Ford Company the first four-wheel drives. They were very primitive, and he undertook a trip to visit this place that Hassan and Bey had discovered, Jebel Weynat. But he started from Cairo, going to the oasis which I described, Oasis Dakhla, and then into the deep desert. By taking this route on the way to Weynat, he stumbled on what we now call Gilf Kebir, this huge mountain region that is, like I said, the size of Switzerland. He was astounded. I mean, believe me, when you see this place, you think, well, how come people didn't know it was here? It's like saying we didn't know Switzerland existed, you know. But there you are. People didn't know it was there until the 1920s. What later was known about Gilf Kebir is that it contained also a lot of rock art. The famous Cave of Swimmers was discovered by a Hungarian explorer, which whose person was used for the film. I don't know if you've seen the film, The English Patient.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah, I have.
The English Patient is modeled on Count Laszlo Elmasi, who, of all things, was also a spy for the German army. And he had the desert bug. And he decided to go to Gilf Kebir after it was discovered. And he convinced a rich British couple who owned a small plane. And that's how the film was done, by the way. They used that story. They flew there and camped for several days. And he discovered the famous Cave of Swimmers. It's a very weird place. It's actually not so much a cave. It's a giant ledge in a place we call today Wadi Sura. Wadi Sura means the place of drawings, because it's full of these rock art. Wadi means valley in Arabic. And the Cave of Swimmers, hence its name, shows these prehistoric people actually swimming. You know, so there must have been water. You can see them diving and having a good time. I actually slept in the Cave of Swimmers in April 2008. I can tell you, it was a very weird experience. And so all this started emerging. There was this new area, but it took a long time for anthropologists and Egyptologists to study this place. It's still very much unexplored, by the way, mainly because of its remoteness. But here is the interesting thing, is that although we were aware that there was prehistoric people there at some distant past, they've left us the drawings, there is a lot of artifacts about. One of the things that is very exciting is that when you are in those regions, you find artifacts all over the place. There are stone tools and grinding bowls, and they're all over the place. Sadly, they're for the taking, because many people now have gone there as tourists and taken. It's now been declared a national park, so at least it's reasonably safe. However, what Egyptologists were utterly convinced is that even though these people were there, they were unknown to the pharaohs. The pharaohs, as far as they were concerned, could not have traveled there. The reason that they came to this conclusion is that on paper, you cannot travel to these regions by donkey, even by camel, to be honest. I mean, it takes a rather unusual organization to do that. But we know that the ancient Egyptians, until the 5th century before Christ, which very late in their history, did not have the camel. They had the donkey. And we know they traveled by donkey. They've left us a lot of drawings, a lot of texts saying that they were traveling by donkey, and they did travel in the along the Oasis route. But no way could they have gone to those places, for the simple reason that it's impossible to carry the amount of water you need. It's a bit like trying to travel from Los Angeles to New York with a motorcycle, with one tank. You're just not going to do it. What you're going to need is fuel stations, right? And without refueling, you can't do it. And this was the status quo until 1999, when came along another one of these weird desert explorers, in this case a German man called Carlo Bergmann. Carlo Bergmann, of all things, was the representative of the Ford company in Egypt. And when he saw the desert, he resigned from his job, divorced his wife, bought 11 camels, and said, I'm going to explore the desert. And he's been there ever since. As far as I know, he's still there. What Carlo Bergmann did was actually explore... Are you still there, Rita?
I'm still here. This is just fascinating.
Right. What Carlo Bergmann did was to explore the desert with camels. I'm saying this because Egyptologists and anthropologists have been missing out by exploring these regions with cars. You have to go on foot. You know, you miss out a lot if you're just driving around. Sometimes you pass a cave a few yards away with prehistoric rock art and you don't see it. You really have to be that close. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he did that, and what Carlo Bergmann discovered, to cut a long story short, is what is known today as the Abu Balas Trail. He discovered these water stations that the pharaohs used in order to travel in the desert. They actually had built water stations. They're very weird. They're there. I mean, you can actually see them. I went to see a few of them. There is a kind of a string of them leading 700 kilometers all the way from Dakhla Oasis all the way to Gils Kebir. In other words, that they had these water stations. What they did is that they sent emissaries to fill up jars, huge jars of water, which were left there so when there was a expedition, the water was there for them to refuel. And that's how they traveled. We know that for a fact now, because even though Carlo Bergmann discovered these water stations, there was no evidence at Gilfi Kebir or at Jebel Uweinat of the pharaohs having reached there. There was nothing, no signs of them at all. Until 2007. And that's where I come in, or rather that's when two very good friends of mine, an Egyptian, Mahmoud Marai, who had been a tour guide for many, many years, a desert tour guide, and another friend of mine called Mark Borda. Mark Borda lives in Malta, he is a businessman, but he got the desert bug. And he contracted Mahmoud Barai to take him to Jebel Uwainat. They went there to look for rock art. But what they found surprised us all. They found pharaonic inscriptions, proving that the pharaohs had been there. And not just pharaonic inscriptions, but pharaonic inscriptions of the pyramid age. It's quite amazing. So now we know that the pyramid builders actually traveled that far to the very edge, the very corner of Egypt, which is that region of Jebel Uwainat. And the inscriptions say that they met there people from the kingdom of Yam. Now, the kingdom of Yam has always been a mystery to the Egyptologists. They supposed, it's mentioned in many, many texts, many ancient texts, but they had supposed that it was further south along the Nile into the Sudan. What this proves is that it was in fact in the deep desert. It's not Jebel Uwainat. Jebel Uwainat was a meeting place. The inscriptions say that they actually met these people there. The pharaoh sent an envoy to meet an envoy of the kingdom of Yam, and they met at Jebel Uwainat, probably because that's the place where it's the most logical place to meet, because there is water. It's the only place where there is water. And this changed the picture entirely. And when I heard this, when Mark Borda phoned me up and said, we found these inscriptions, I just had to see them. And I organized an expedition in 2008 with Tom Brophy, and we actually went there. And it's changed. It's not only changed my views, because having been in Egypt for so many years, having studied the pharaonic civilization for so many years, suddenly I saw it in a very different light. You really realize how the whole thing, the whole puzzle begins to fit once you start going to those places. You begin to see it on a much larger scale. And in any case, we undertook an expedition of 10 days. We reached Jebel Uwainat after 5 days of open desert travel. I can tell you it's quite a feat, sleeping in the dunes. it's changed. The people who came on the expedition will never be the same again, I can tell you. It was quite an experience. To be, even for this short period of time, in this wilderness, in this open desert, to be living for a short while, detached completely from civilization, and meeting the ancestors, because when you reach there, you actually meet them, well, you see them in drawings. Mm-hmm. It's very eerie. We hadn't yet thought of doing a book. I recall sitting one evening with Tom Brophy in a campfire, and the idea came, should we do a book on this? And that's how Black Genesis was born. These recent discoveries show that even amateurs like Mark Borda, Mahmoud Barai, and the German Carlo Bergmann can make major discoveries. The place is for the taking. It's been unexplored. It's where this prehistoric people stayed for thousands of years, and it must be full. One of the things that we have not yet found is human remains. We have not found yet a burial or a tomb or any human remains. It's a big mystery. They must be there, of course, but it shows you how little explored it is. And
That seems like it's a common problem in a lot of different geographical areas where they know there's civilization, but no human remains. I mean, that doesn't... There's a big mystery there.
Well, hold on. I mean, in this particular region, the mystery is that... The mystery is the Egyptologists themselves. I mean, I don't understand why there hasn't been expeditions organized over the last years. I mean, for me to be the first person after the discovery of these inscriptions, Mahmoud Marai and Mark Borda, when they returned from Jebel Uwainat, having discovered the inscriptions, announced them in the newspaper. But nothing happened. You would have thought that the Egyptologists would have run there to see them. It's a unique discovery. But nothing happened. They were very disappointed. I mean, they actually went to the antiquity department. They actually saw Zahirwas and said, oh, yeah, very interesting. But
it changes the history. I mean, that's the whole thing. It changes the history, and he doesn't seem like he wants it to change.
And it changes the history, it changes the geography, but it changes something else, which I think is not something Zahi wants to change, is that Zahi is very much against the notion that the pharaohs originated in Black Africa. You know, he's very, very anti-Black Africa. So, but, you know, he can huff and puff. I mean, the evidence is coming out and it's now published.
But when you look at the statuary of a number of the pharaohs, you know, they look a little weird, but if you put in your mind, this is a person that has Negroid features, you know, then the big lips and the flat nose make a whole lot more sense.
Yes. It depends which period you're talking about.
Agreed.
There is no doubt in my mind at all that original ethnic appearance of the Egyptians, or what we call the Egyptians, the original Egyptians, were Black Africans. You don't have to have statues. I mean, all you have to do is go in the south. If you go in the Nubian area, the Egyptians are black. I mean, they're black Africans. And when you definitely go in the Sahara and you go in the Oasis, the majority of people are black. They're descendants from these original prehistoric people. There is no doubt at all. There are pictures of these black African Egyptians in Kyprogenesis. I mean, it's very, very obvious. However, we're talking about the early stages when these people came and settled in the Nile, when these black African people came and settled in the Nile. Now, what happened 1,000 years later? Yes, of course, there was a migration from the Levant, there was migration from the Mediterranean, and the race began to mix, and this is why you have a very varied people in Egypt. You can range from almost Caucasian, which comes from the mixture of Turkish and Syrian and European, to the dark black African. I mean, there are black Africans who are blacker than black Africans in Egypt. I mean, wonderful people. The Nubians are extraordinary people. Their features are so obviously sub-Saharan. So, to me, there is no doubt. But, of course, you know, it depends. If you're talking about the Middle Kingdom, then it's not surprising that you find all this mixture of ethnic groups, because they had intermingled by then. It's a bit like the United States, you know. I mean, there was originally the American Indian, but now you have a hodgepodge of races. What's happened over the last 300 years is this mixture, and that's only 300 years. So if you look at Egypt 3,000 years, it's not surprising at all that there is that variety. But the origins, like in America, was black African, there's no doubt. And it's so obvious. I mean, Egypt buttresses against Africa. Its southern frontiers are in Africa. Egypt is an African country. You know, we have a tendency to call it the Middle East, but Egypt is in Africa. You know, it's in North Africa, but it's in Africa. And the Nile is fed from Central Africa. We know that the pharaohs, even in later times, traveled deep into Central Africa. So I think the puzzle is clear, and there is no doubt at all in my mind, and there is no doubt at all in the minds of many anthropologists. It's becoming very kosher now to discuss this almost as a matter of fact. In fact, speaking of which, there is a major conference in Atlanta in September, of which I will attend, and Tom Brophy, called the Nile Valley Civilization Conference. I think it's on the 26th of September. You can Google it. And it's about this. There's major academics coming, some from Africa, some from American universities, one of them being the University of Columbia in Washington, D.C., of which I gave a talk in February this year. There's a great interest in this now, because it changes the picture. It changes the picture of who we are. And I think it's a wonderful thing to have realized this now, that we all have a common source. You know, all this nonsense going about the world and, you know, clashes of civilization and the Arab uprising and all this is nonsense, because we all have a common root. It's proven. It's genetically proven. And to wake up to this is a wonderful thing. that in fact there is the word race is not used anymore by anthropologists. There is no such thing as race. We are all from the very same human origin. The only difference is that we change skin color. It's a question of melanin dosage. That's all it is. And to wake up to this and to realize that the differences that we as humans have been subjected to are artificial. You know, borders. When you study anthropology, when you go and travel in the desert, things like borders and nationalities become irrelevant. These are things we've invented. When you are in the desert, you are there in the world. You are there in the primordial world, where you've got to imagine a world without roads, without borders, without countries, without towns. This is the world that existed for millions of years, where humans have existed in this world for millions of years without all this. You know, so we've got to wake up to this awareness that we have created an artificial world that needs to be reconsidered, because we are creating a dangerous world with all these differences. It's time to reunite everybody, and the study of anthropology leading us into a common source is very, very beneficial, not just to know our origins, but to change our perception about who we are. So I add a lot of this in my talks these days, because I think it's vitally important. It comes at the right moment. There is a globalization going on, and we're going to need to think differently. We're going to stop thinking about Chinese and Russians and Arabs and Muslims and Christians. We're all the same. And it's okay to have Sorry, yes, go on.
Because people are people.
Well, it's the truth. It's a very fundamental truth. We are human beings with the same ancestral mother. It's a fact now. We all come from that first human that was born in Central Africa from this unknown African Eve, and we're the product. And if we are Russian or American or Turkish, it doesn't matter, because what has happened is mere mutations that have changed our external features. The packaging is different, but the content is the same. And we need to realize this. It's a fact. It's not a philosophical argument. And it's so vitally important, because it's changed me. I mean, since I've been studying and looking at civilization in this way and going all the way down to the root. There is a chapter, by the way, in Black Genesis that looks into the study of empty DNA. And once you look at it that way, there are some wonderful statements from anthropologists who have boldly said that they're not going to use the word race, like I said earlier, because it doesn't make sense anymore. There's no such thing as a race. You know, these are anthropological facts. And we've tried to popularize them in Black Genesis, because it isn't just a study of how this pharaonic civilization started. It is an epiphany of waking up as human beings and saying we realize that we come from the same source. You know, and I kind of stunned an audience in Washington, at the University of Washington, D.C., when I said, I'd like to finish my talk by saying that I'm proud to be a black African turned white. I had a moment of silence, a few seconds of silence, I thought, whoops, they didn't quite catch this, and then they all went and applauded, because I've stated the truth. That's what it mm-hmm. is. And, you know, it's... as you can imagine, I've had some pretty nasty little letters, you know, on my Facebook about this, from people who were resisting this, but they're fewer and fewer.
I think from a racial point of view, there's less resistance from people, and now we're just really dealing with the religious and philosophical perspectives. I mean, because you can have two people from the Middle East, or three people, one Christian, one Jew, one Muslim, and they will fight to the death over their belief system, even though they look the same.
Exactly. I mean, this is in fact what The Master Game attempts to do as well. The book I've written with Graham Hancock, which is coming out in August, is that the irony of these religious differences is not only that they shouldn't be. I mean, I was talking about Ahmed Osman earlier on, and Ahmed Osman has written several books on this. He's one of those rare Muslims who says that it's anti-Quranic to try to impose what some are trying to impose called Sharia, what they call Islamic law. There's no such thing as Islamic law. There is the Quran, yes, but there is no mention at all of Islamic, of Sharia in the Quran. And he's bringing this out, and he's been pillared by clerics, but he's very firm on this. He's a man who has studied the Quran in great detail. That's why I've chosen him as a co-author for this book I'm doing on the antiquities, because we are looking into these matters, because there is a confusion, and it's so important to understand it nowadays. The Arab uprising has woken up the world into these false perceptions that we have about Muslims, about nationalities, and so forth. For example, in Egypt, there is worrying sectarian problems. But the amazing thing is that Egyptians should be aware that before they became Muslims, and before they became Muslims, they were Christians. Before they became Christians, they were pharaonic for 3,000 years. They all come from the same thing. And as a matter of fact, since we're on that topic, the New Testament, which is Christianity, and the Quran, which is Islam, comes from the Old Testament. You know, it's an Abrahamic religion, the three of them. So it's amazing that we think there is a difference.
That part just blows my mind, because they're all saying the same thing.
They do, and I've been reading a book by Ahmed Osman called Christianity and Political Islam, and he devotes many chapters to the... I mean, people are not aware of this, but Muhammad, the prophet, had 13 wives. Two of them were actually Jews, and one of them was Christian. He actually married the daughter of the Christian bishop of Medina. You know, clearly, he had no problems. He totally recognizes, the prophet totally recognized that his religion was based on the Old Testament, that it's based on the Abrahamic, what he calls the Abrahamic origin. He recognizes the prophet Jesus. He recognizes the Virgin Mary. The Virgin Mary is mentioned in the Quran. I mean, there's no... So where is the difference? Why are they killing themselves in Egypt? You know, the Copts and the Muslims. It's total misunderstanding. And these things need to be cleared in the same way that we're clearing the racial issues. You're saying, well, in the United States, of course, racial issues have become much more diffused, and there may be a small pocket of people who are still racist, but it's much diminished. But racism exists very much so in Africa, very much so in the Middle East, I can tell you. And these things need to be removed. If we're going to live in a global world where everybody will live on this planet, we've got to remove these fallacies, these religious fallacies, these racial fallacies, because they are fallacies. You know, they're mistakes. They're mistakes in understanding what the human origins are and what we are as humans on this planet. So this studies are not just studying ancient history. Sorry, I'm getting a bit passionate here, okay? but I think that, you know, people need to see, because I've always seen the study of ancient history, particularly ancient Egyptian history, not just as a interesting hobby. One of the most exciting thing about the pharaonic civilization is that it is a model that was almost perfect. It survived for 3,000-4,000, perhaps even longer now, without strife. They had very little internal problems. They created wonderful arts. I mean, it's there even now for us to see. Wonderful architecture, lived in peace for 3,000 years until they were disturbed by an import of people who saw differences, who misunderstood what their nature was. The Egyptian civilization was very much nature-driven. You know, we need to wake up that we are natural beings living in a natural world, and we've got to think in those terms. You know, we're losing touch with who we are, and this is a very dangerous thing, because the more we lose touch with who we are, the more dangerous we become, the more indifferent we become, the more we are ready to push that red button and blow ourselves up. So we need to see the past as a time when people were living in very harmonious manner with nature, with themselves. I mean, when you go and see the, when you see those drawings in the rock art in the desert, one thing that stuns you is that they seem to be happy. There is no scenes of aggression. They're all dancing. They're all holding hands. They're all swimming, and they were there for thousands of years undisturbed. Human beings lived, even though we consider them primitive, they lived in harmony with their world and they lived in peace. We need to restore that sense. We need to re-educate our world into that, you know. And I'm very much a proponent of this. So my work isn't simply writing about alternative history. I'm beginning to realize that we're touching a very important issue here, because we're at a turning point, a very serious turning point. The world is heading toward either a wonderful globalization, where we will all live in a peaceful world, or in towards a disaster. And we've got to choose. And we've got to choose fast, because these things are moving fast. You know, we've got Iran being a very dangerous country on the verge of obtaining nuclear power. We've got the Arab-Israeli conflict, which hasn't been resolved. We've got this war in Libya. Things are not looking good. So we've got to wake up fast and decide where we're going. And I hope that all this awareness makes us realize that we should be going for unity rather than disunity. We've been separating people and over the last 2,000 years. We need to bring them back together.
And so you don't think that the pharaonic rule was about power and control? You really believe that there was unity and peace among those people? You look at the artwork, and it's, you know, the pharaoh is always shown as being big and, you know, in his war chariot. And then the people are these little people doing all of this stuff.
You know what? It's, you know, you're right. I mean, it depends again on which epoch you're looking at. But I'll tell you one thing. You can't build the pyramids. You can't build the Temple of Karnak. In fact, you can't build those wonderful temples we have with people who are not in perfect harmony with the rulers. I mean, I can tell you that. The organization alone of organizing a people to build the pyramids, you can't do it under the whip. The organization is such that it demonstrates that we had a people who were in not just in unity, but could communicate amazingly over distances, to actually produce these monuments. You know, some of the stones of the pyramids come from Upper Egypt. It takes 2 weeks sailing to go to Upper Egypt to go there, let alone bring the stones down there. There was a system of communication that existed that cannot be with people who were not in unity. The art they produced, the art of the pyramid age is extraordinary. These people carved statues in basalt, in hard granite, in schist stone. It's black basalt is like iron. When you touch it, it actually feels like iron. Michelangelo wouldn't even dare carve a statue with these kind of stones. It's too difficult. And yet they produced this wonderful art. All you have to do is go to the Cairo Museum, and you're not looking at people who were oppressed. You're looking at an explosion of creativity. This is what ancient Egypt was. Left us a wonderful religion of what I call a natural religion. They had no hang-ups like we do. I mean, the religion was open. There was no sexual taboos. There was no... they lived... you can see it in their drawings. I mean, when you go to the Temple of Phila, the temple of Philae. You can't build a temple of Philae with people that are oppressed. It's a temple that exudes harmony and love, and you feel like you're in some sort of dream. This is ancient Egypt, and it was there for thousands of years. You know, that's why people are attracted to it, by the way. You know, particularly Americans. I mean, we get people coming, and they're enthralled. They're enthralled. They're mystified. You know, I've lived 3 years outside the pyramids. I actually had a flat, Rita, overlooking the Great Pyramid. For 3 years I was there having breakfast, having lunch, you know, on my balcony. And it's amazing, you know, when you look at this monument, you can't help, I mean, it doesn't matter how many times you see it. You are struck by a sense of... Well, you're struck by a sense of awe. I mean, you know, you're talking about a monument that is at least, if even one accepts the Orthodox dating, almost 5,000 years old. It shouldn't be there. It's too big. It's too large. It's too perfect. It's too mysterious. It's too exciting. It's a mystery that induces the mind when you're visiting Egypt and you look at all these places. It kind of takes your mind into a mood where you want to join it. You know, people want to stay at temples and meditate, and they feel very, very sad when they leave. I've just taken a group to Egypt in April, May, and it's quite amazing what it did to those people.
I did offer to go on that trip and like get here for you, but they said that might not be enough. So I was like, well, all right.
What was it enough? Sorry,
to just like go be the beer runner. You know, oh, you want a beer? Okay, I'll go get that.
Well, we had 45 people. There was Graham Hancock with us, and they had the experience of their lives, I can tell you. And more so because it was post-revolution, and the sites were rather empty from tourism. So we had some temples just to ourselves. But what they saw, you know, they were expecting some. They were expecting to be enthralled and all this, but they weren't expecting that kind of effect.
I have to tell you, we went on Google Maps the other day, and my husband was looking for something, I don't know. And so he was like zooming around the Cairo area, and he's like, where are the pyramids? Where are the pyramids? And from this one point, we caught the corner of one in the screen and then slightly zoomed in so that they were, I don't know, maybe squares about a half an inch square on, he has a pretty good sized screen. Mm-hmm. And what blew us away was, okay, these are only a half an inch in size, but there's like three or four city blocks that that little half an inch takes up. And it's like, we thought they were big, but we were even just blown away from the Google pictures at how really big.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I've had the chance to fly over the pyramids. I've actually climbed the pyramids several times. But the first thing you see from altitude are the pyramids. You actually don't see Cairo. The buildings are far too small for you to notice. So if you're an alien flying down on Earth in the Cairo area, the first thing you'll see is the pyramids. They're that big. You can actually see the pyramids from 25 kilometers away. And you see their peaks before you even see the city of Cairo. It's an amazing sight, I can tell you. But you know, the pyramids, of course, are the pinnacle, and the most dramatic sight in ancient Egypt, but there are literally hundreds of other places. One of the places that gets me and my visitors, especially in this last visit, was the temple of Ramses II, Abu Simbel. Have you been there?
I haven't been to Egypt. Every time I say I want to go...
What, Rita?
That's why I said I would get you the beer. Every time I want to go, the comments I get is, but there's too much unrest. There's too much unrest. And I'm like, so I can't ever find anybody to go with me.
No, okay.
I can hang out with you, Robert.
We're organizing what we call an all-Nile trip, literally. Doing the whole Nile from north to south, which is what we did in April, for February. So I'll give you the details, and I'll have you as a special guest. How about that?
Okay.
You know, I've lived all in all about 25 years in Egypt. I've lived opposite the Great Pyramid for 3 years. I've done I don't know how many tours visiting all these temples, but it still gets you. I mean, I presume you know of John West. John West says the same thing. John says every time he goes at Giza and he sees the Sphinx, he gets a hit. You know, you're looking at something that is extraordinary and hoary with age and so mysterious. That's one of the things that the word mysterious comes into mind every time you look at these monuments. I've described them once as a giant question mark looming. You know, you're there and they provoke you. They defy you. They defy us today. I mean, they defy engineers. We don't know how they build these things. You know, I used to be a construction engineer. My brother is an architect, and they're defiant. They provoke your mind, and maybe that's what they were there for.
Do you believe the 3500 BC date? Thank you.
Date? No, sorry, no, I didn't. I thought you were going to say alien.
Oh. No, the date.
Although I appear in Ancient Aliens in the next series, I will appear quite a lot in it. But the dating, you know, my conclusion is that there are two dates at Giza. One of them is the Orthodox date. I'm pretty sure that there was activity, and probably a large part of the pyramid construction was done in about 2500 BC, as the Egyptologists say. Excuse me. But two sciences, the science of geology, which was Robert Schock's and John West's work, and the science of astronomy, which is mine and Graham Hancock, demonstrate that there is a greater antiquity there as well. What we're beginning to believe is that there was what we call a megalithic phase. Again, it doesn't take a rocket engineer when you visit Giza to realize that there is two types of construction. There is one which seems to be much older, the temples, the so-called valley temples and the mortuary temples, which are built with giant, literally giant blocks, some of them weighing about 150 tons. 150 tons is taking 200 family cars and squishing them together. That's 150 tons. You know, we are puzzled not only as to how they move these stones, we're puzzled as to why, because there is absolutely no reason to build a temple using that kind of large size stones. I mean, it's madness, and yet they did it. And but on the other hand, the pyramids are built, although with large stones, they're much more manageable. They're the average weight of the pyramid stones are about 2 tons, and although that's pretty heavy, it's nowhere near the 150 tons that are used for the temples. You would have thought the other way around. So there is something that is very clearly different between these two constructions, and those very large stone temples, clearly, again, you don't need to be a geologist to realize this, they look much more eroded, they look much older. And so we're beginning to look at Giza with this kind of perception. I'm doing a lot of, I'm involved very, very much in this side of studies now, and I'm in dialogue with Robert Schock, who's a very good friend of mine. Robert Schock, the geologist from Boston.
We had him on a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, did you? Well, you must have talked to this. There you are. So I was with Robert Schock in Poland a few weeks ago. And so I think that's what we have there. We have a much older phase. I would date that phase around the 12th millennium BC, around there. And that matches very nicely with Lambda Playa. If I'm going to sort of throw in a hunch, I think that we had these prehistoric people taking excursions from where they were into the Nile Valley and left their imprint. I think what we're going to discover in the next few decades is that much of buildings which have perplexed us, like these temples at Giza and the Osirion at Abydos, are fingerprints. Whoops, what's that?
That's the music, but I think it's perfect timing.
Yeah,
because you just kind of like hit a nice ending point right there.
Yes, absolutely.
But I have to have you back because I feel like we just barely scratched.
Let's
okay.